So the talk tonight is about practicing with the four Brahma Viharas in our daily lives. So you will have caught that phrase, in our daily lives. We're at the beginning of a transition in our retreat, a slow turning of our attention towards the outside world. Our return home, our re-engagement with out there. Some of you are probably very excited about this, and others of you are probably not. Others of you may be feeling reluctant about giving up the seclusion and the silence of the retreat. I'm feeling poignant just saying it. It's its own equanimity practice, the ending of a retreat. Really landing in this is the way it is now. This is not the way it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago or how it'll be next week or the week after, but this is the way it is now. And seeing if our hearts can be wide and spacious enough to land right there. Sometimes yes, probably sometimes no. The other day, Bhante said to me that a number of years ago, he heard me give a talk where I talked about being equanimous with not being equanimous. And he liked it so much, he remembered it all these years. I call that radical equanimity, being equanimous with not being equanimous. So I recommend it. You'll probably get a chance to practice it sometime in the coming days. And you may have noticed that the schedule posted for tomorrow has a slight change. Late afternoon, don't worry, it's low-key. You're going to be okay. We start you off easy, really easy, and then help you acclimate over the next few days to talking more and engaging more. It's like Iris Bonita, right? Putting out her paw and connecting with Sparky. That's what you're going to get to do. I asked for an update on their relationship today, hoping I would have something new to offer you, but it's slow. Anyway, onto the talk. Some of you might remember Greg giving talks. Greg sometimes gives an introduction to a talk that's like at least half his talk. Yeah, he still does that. Yeah. It's pretty funny. He gives good introductions, though, doesn't he? Yes. Probably better than mine. All right, onwards. So a question I get a lot these days as a teacher is, what do I do about all the suffering? Guess it's my third suffering talk, my third dukkha talk. How can I engage and not get overwhelmed? In addition, there's this unasked question that often lurks beneath. How do I deal with the colossal anguish I feel about the state of the world? So in any situation of great suffering, we want to both engage and take care of our hearts. And the framework of the four Brahma Viharas provides one way to engage in the world in a sustainable and even joyful way in the midst of sorrow and lots of suffering. So we establish goodwill. We call on fierce compassion. We care enough to act. We sustain ourselves through joy. And we let go of attachment to the results of our actions. Romain Rolland said, there is only one heroism in this world, to see the world as it is and to love it. So in many ways, that's what this talk is about. There's a teacher Tibetan teacher in California that I love a lot named Anam Thubten. And in his book, Embracing Each Moment, he says, I'm always talking about the idea of melting. I talk about it perhaps more than anything else these days. I used to talk about enlightenment quite a bit. Then as time went by, I changed my vocabulary. These days, I hardly ever talk about enlightenment. Luckily, nobody hasn't complained. Nobody has approached me and said that I don't talk enough about enlightenment. Melting is the experience of not having any sense of being contracted or shut down in any way. Instead, it is having the feeling that you can trust this world, you can trust this universe, and you can trust this human life. It is totally irrational. Just like love, love is irrational. Just like compassion, it's totally irrational. Can you understand the feeling of trusting life? So there's no longer a you who is somehow defending your own existence, your own physical territory, your own mental territory, your own egoistic territory, and who is trying to fight or flee from the outer world. This sense of trust comes naturally when you are no longer bound by your own fear. This trust that I'm speaking of is also a form of love. It's not so much that you love somebody or something, but that you become love. So back to our question, how do we engage in this world of so much joy, but also so much suffering, and not be overwhelmed? How do we love in this world? That's a question I ask all the time. How do we love in this world the way it is? I'll tell you a story. It won't surprise you that I consider myself a climate activist, and I spend a lot of time in the woods. I think I mentioned that once before, every day if I can. And over near my house, I have a bunch of trails I take and places I go, and I have little, I call them power spots. They're spots that I stop to sit and meditate, but not really, just be there and see what happens. That's meditation. And it's like I have a relationship at these places. Like the land knows me, I know the land. The rocks know me, the marsh knows me, I know the marsh. And so there was one day I was out at my favorite rock in the middle of the woods. I have to bushwhack to it. But as you know, I know how to do that. And I was just sitting there, just being. And I started to really tune into the fact that the woods were quieter than they used to be. And the trees, you know, there's not so many birds singing, and the trees, they don't look as healthy as they used to. And I felt so much grief for this world, and I let room for the grief. It's really important that we leave room for our grief. If not, it clogs up all the arteries. We have to leave room. So I was leaving room to it, for it, just feeling kind of what my species has done. And in the middle of this grief, the spirit beings of the trees, the spirit beings of the land, they communicated, they said, we're still here. Love us as we are now. And it was such a great teaching. I've been, like, you know, digesting that for months. We're still here. Love us as we are now. I saw that in the grief and despair, I was denying the truth of now, and that these were hindering my capacity to love more deeply. The trees and the land wanted me to love them as they are now, not as they used to be, not as they might be, not as I think they're going to be, but right now in the midst of all the changes. And my heart relaxed, and once more I felt in attunement with the beings of the land and more able to connect with love. And then I thought, perhaps we can look at our aging bodies the same way. Love them as they are now. Not as they used to be, not as we worry that they will be. It always comes back to love me as I am now. Love with the open fist, without comparing to any other time, without wanting something else. And it's the only way we can love in this world that is burning with change. So Hallmark is a gift card, for those of you who don't know, it's a gift card company. Anyway, Hallmark has kind of squashed every bit of authenticity out of the word love. I'm gonna try to reclaim it. I want to reclaim that word for a spiritual kind of love, or unconditional love, or this boundless heart, this unfettered, unbound heart, the wide, caring, kind heart. And in our practice, we're cultivating a mature love for this world. Not a Hallmark love, but a mature love, a love that is in touch with reality, in touch with the depth and breadth of joy and sorrow in this world, in touch with the truth of change. So we're exploring this question, and we can explore it for years and years and years. What does it mean to love in this world? So the four Brahmaviharas are one answer to that question. A teacher named Martin Ellwards said, he describes the four Brahmaviharas like this, and I really like it. The heart loves. The heart responds. The heart delights. And the heart allows. That's a mature love. A well-rounded love. So listening to this talk, you might think of where it's applicable in your life. What life situations do you encounter a lot of suffering? Perhaps you are or have been a frontline worker during the pandemic, and in some way, the broadest definition of that term. Or you're a social worker who works with people who are suffering. Or an activist working for change. Or a caretaker for an elderly or sick person or a child. Or maybe just your aging body gives you plenty of material to think of this question, how to love a chronic illness. Perhaps the daily grind of the oppression of racism or transphobia gives you plenty to work with. I've used this framework of the Brahmaviharas very consciously when I worked as a therapist in the inner city, in activism and in dealing with health challenges. This talk is also just about sharing love in this world that so desperately needs it. Love is not optional these days. So we start with establishing goodwill in our own hearts, and we commit to sharing this with all beings. It's not a small gift, it's huge. We can really appreciate it. Can you remember some time perhaps when you were heartbroken, some loss, and you were just feeling devastated, and somebody smiled at you, or somebody did the smallest little kind, held the door for you? And how it changed your whole day. That's kindness, and we can do that. The opportunities are endless. And we can train our heart to this default of spreading kindness. Ruth King wrote in one of her books, a white Dharma sister shared an eye-opening story of being at a political rally for Palestinian women in Northern California. She asked the Palestinian women, "What can I do for you?" To which the Palestinian woman responded, "We like it when people smile at us." So we can always choose friendliness. We can choose a smile. Metta senses our kinship with all beings. We train our hearts and minds towards the default of seeing the good. We connect with the truth that all beings want to be happy, from the littlest insect to the biggest human. And as our hearts melt, the shielding of our hearts melt, we become more fully connected to that kinship. We feel it more intensely. All things become more alive in this world, not just people and animals, but trees and plants and rocks and tables. Everything is a chance to share this kinship. To the feeling intuitive mind, plants and minerals are also alive and vibrant and responsive beings. I don't know if some of you have had that experience that you have a familiar rock on the trail, and maybe as you walk by, you give it a little pat. It becomes your friend. Once I was teaching a metta retreat in the springtime at IMS, and at the place that I was staying, sugar ants tended to show up and during this retreat pretty reliably every year. And I tried to be careful. But one morning I was a little careless and impatient, and I killed a few of the ants by accident. The next morning, there weren't any ants. And my first thought was, where are my friends? I felt kinship with those little ants. I didn't want them taking over my kitchen, but they were beings who also wanted to live. So we aspire to approach life with less aggression and more gentleness. We put down a book as an act of metta. Walk on the earth as an act of metta. Spread metta while we're stuck in traffic or on the subway. Einstein was once asked, if he could have the answer to one question, what question would he choose? And his question was, is the world friendly? I'm not sure there's a completely objective answer to his question. Because the world becomes a friendlier place for us when we practice metta. We're not naive. We know that there's a lot of violence in this world and white supremacists and people who want to do harm. And yet, we're saying that we have some choice about the flavor of our own heart. The filter, you could say, with which we see the world. We commit to seeing through eyes of kindness. My husband and I moved to our current house about 5 years ago, and there was a next door neighbor that I didn't know well. I could tell it was the son of the man who lived next door, and I could tell that we probably didn't move in the same social circles. And he would run a lot on the road around the same time I would be out on my bike often. And he seemed like he might be really shy. But I just started to say, hi, how are you? Hi, neighbor. And he would kind of at first like, maybe just the smallest response. And then over time, he got, pretty robust response, pretty good. And then one time I was driving my car and he was running and he saw me and he waved first. And I was like, yay for metta. We create a friendly world around us. Again, I'm not naive. I know that there are situations that are dangerous and we have to be careful. But we commit our own hearts to be grounded in love and vow to see the world through those eyes. Some of you might know a song by the Resistance Revival Chorus Choir, a collective of more than 60 women and non-binary singers dedicated to joy and activism. And they remind us of the strength in our hearts that come from knowing how to touch the metta that resides there. Some lines from the song. This love in my heart, the world didn't give it to me. The world didn't give it, and the world can't take it away. This joy in my heart, the world didn't give it to me. The world didn't give it, and the world can't take it away. This peace in my heart, the world didn't give it to me. The world didn't give it, and the world can't take it away. Feel free to listen to the song later. I thought of playing it tonight, but I thought that might be a bit too much. We'll ease you in. And then in this time of such political and social division, it's a great question of how do we practice metta in those situations? How do we heal the divide? One way is that while we're sitting here for 6 weeks or 3 months, we deeply understand our own humanity. We understand that on a core level, we're not any different than those that we may not like or those that we may not agree with. How many of us have seen how mean-spirited we can be? I've seen it. How many of us have seen the depths of greed and aversion and how they can control our behavior unconsciously? We know that, right? As we know ourselves more fully, our full humanity, the broad spectrum of what this heart, body, mind is capable of, we really begin to understand all humans much better. If they're causing harm, of course, we try to stop that harm, but we can do it from a place of shared humanity and not division. I've heard that there are libraries where you can check out people. So you can check out somebody who's from a group that you're curious about that you don't know. So like a Palestinian woman, you could check out a Palestinian woman and you sit down together and you can ask anything you want. And it's said that most people become friends. So there's, you know, wide spectrum. You can check out a baker. You can check out somebody from a different ethnic background from yourself, somebody from a different sexual orientation, somebody who just, it's vast. I'm blanking right now, but in my own town, there's a divide between the people who have been there for their whole lives or before that, so the people are more local, and the people like me who are recent arrivals 23 years ago. If you weren't born in the town, you're a recent arrival. And there's this kind of division. It's not, it pops up every once in a while. It's not like super charged, but it is with certain issues that come up. And I'm always trying to see how I can heal that division. So when I first moved in about 20 years ago, a little over 20 years ago, people from my social group, they go down to Northampton about a half hour away to get their hair cut. But I decided to get my hair cut at a local place, you know, the nearby town. And don't blame her. I've been chopping it for the last, you know, 6 weeks. I've been trimming to try not to get it too long. And when I walked into this place the first time, I felt so out of place. It was like the posters on the wall, the pictures, the music, everything was like, these are not the people I usually hang out with. And I kept going back. partly because I wanted to heal the divide. And I have such a great friendship with my hairdresser now. She's been cutting my hair for 20 years. You know, I've gone with her from being in her late 20s to her late 40s, having a daughter growing up. Like, you know, we know each other's lives. You know how you talk to your hairdresser. And we're respectful. We may have different opinions about things. I don't really know how she feels about a lot of things because we're really kind of give each other a lot of space. But when I went to Burma a number of years ago, I ordained temporarily. You can do that in Burma. So I got all my hair cut off. And so I wasn't going to get my hair cut. And I thought, I should tell her, you know, so she doesn't wonder what happened to me. So I walked in. I'm like, I don't know if our relationship can survive this. It's quite bizarre, you know. I'm pretty much almost bald. I have like a half inch of hair. And first of all, they don't recognize me. And then I'm like, it's Rebecca. And they're like, and they were so curious. They're like, oh, I told them I'd been a nun, shaved my head. They knew I was Buddhist. And they're like, oh, well, what makes you a nun? I told them about the precepts. They were really interested, especially one on celibacy. They found that fascinating. You know, we had a really good chat. I had underestimated them. And they still, every once in a while, mention it. Do you remember that time? Because it was so shocking. Anyway, healing the divide. How do we heal the divide? Well, it's a half hour and I'm only done with one Brahma VR. Okay, let's move on. Compassion. So, as you know, compassion, we cultivate the ability to respond to suffering with care and tenderness and the wish to help. Compassion is often confusing. It's one that we learn. We often need to unlearn unhelpful conditioning that we got and relearn what is true compassion. So sometimes our family, for example, might tell us that if somebody's suffering and you're not distraught, that means you don't care, right? That's like some conditioning we can get. That's just, it's not true. We have to unlearn that one. Compassion has a sweet quality. We talked about this the other day, of connection. And a poignant quality of the truth of suffering. It's wide enough to include suffering as a reality. So we see that hating suffering is not compassion, right? Another thing we might wonder about. Greg Boyle is a Roman Catholic Jesuit who founded Homeboy Industries in Latin America, the largest gang intervention program in the world. And he said, just assume the answer to every question is compassion. And he said, at Homeboy, love is the answer, community is the context, and tenderness is the methodology. So we attune to suffering, let it tenderize our hearts, soften the calluses over our hearts. He said tenderness is the finishing touch on love. The famous Zen master Dogen said that the purpose of practice is to develop a tender heart. So compassion has several facets. One of them is this kind of tenderness, the warmth, melting the ice mountains of our heart, softening into suffering rather than bracing against it, soothing. And then as we talked about the other day, it's also an empowered state of heart. They might misconceive of compassion as wimpy, too strong to stand up. But in reality, its strength comes from not crumbling in the face of suffering. Sometimes we need to focus on fierce compassion, that deep inner strength that doesn't crumble in the face of suffering. I think of Greta Thunberg and her climate vigil, right? Day after day at first, all by herself, day after day after day. Wow, that's fierce compassion to have that kind of perseverance. Or Malala Yousafzai. She, the Palestinian or the Pakistani education rights activist who bravely fights for the rights of education for girls in her country. She says, I read in National Geographic, I'm no different than other girls. I just had the opportunity and the circumstances that supported me to do what I did. There's a spacious kind of compassion there. The stories are everywhere. Fierce compassion is much more prevalent than we would be led to believe by reading the news. But we can tune our dial to seeing these examples that will inspire us and remind us of the fierceness in our own hearts. Empathetic distress is not compassion. Empathetic distress collapses into suffering. It's a type of despair. Sharon said that when she was teaching about compassion in Russia once, she had this feeling the translator was not quite translating the word compassion like she wanted him to. So she says to him, how do you translate compassion? And he said, I describe the state of being totally overcome with someone's sorrow like having a stake through your heart and having the burden of someone's pain burning in you too. We laugh, but sometimes we think that's compassion, right? No, that's empathetic distress. Compassion is strong, tender, spacious. There's a wider context that we're able to hold. I just think of it as, how large can my heart get? How large can my heart get to hold suffering, to have it allowed its presence? And we're always kind of extending those boundaries. And lastly, compassion is response. Thich Nhat Hanh says it's a verb, not a noun. One student once described to me these feelings of being overwhelmed by all the news that she heard on the radio, all the suffering, and asked what she could do. And I said, do something, respond in some way, however small. Responding to suffering serves as an antidote to collapse and despair. We have agency. We can focus on the integrity of our actions, even if the results are out of our control. It counteracts the powerlessness that we can feel these days with the enormous amount of suffering that we hear about. Do something, no matter how small. It changes our hearts. I like this one, an NPR interview. The interviewer asked an economist what makes a boss good. He said, there are some things that might be really hard to measure. She says, well, if you could measure anything, what would you measure? What would you be looking for? he pauses, hesitates, and says, well, compassion, though I'll probably lose my economist card for saying that. So if we're a boss, maybe we can practice compassion. As we engage with suffering, we can also answer our need for joy and sustainability, mudita. Delighting in our good fortune and the beauty around us balances out compassion. It helps us not drown in the breadth and depth of suffering. It's energizing and refreshing. Can we feel this joy all the way down to the cellular level? Can we let our body, heart, and mind marinate in joy? It helps, as Joanna Macy says, to sustain our enthusiasm. Like sustainable farming, we need to make sure that there are inputs into the soil of our heart that keeps it healthy year after year. Appreciative joy is sustainable farming for our hearts, nourishing the soil of our practice with energizing inputs so that we can be present for life enthusiastically, day after day and year after year. I bank appreciative joy frequently. I mean, I consciously every day tune myself to the beauty around me. It might just, like I was walking today down on that path and there was just some bush that all of a sudden stood out. It was, brown, but it had this beautiful color to it. I banked that, I let that touch my heart. And I do that kind of thing all day. And in this day, with the amount of suffering that is present, we need it a lot. Years ago, I worked in an inner city clinic. It was my first job as a psychotherapist. I was in my mid-30s. And I encountered enormous amounts of suffering, inner city life, you can imagine. And when I first started working there, I was a pretty naive, white 30-something. And I was so overwhelmed and distressed by what I was seeing day after day. But over time, I began to understand that I was limiting my clients by just focusing on the suffering. I started to notice and appreciate the joy in their lives. Close family ties, a good meal, the birth of a grandchild, music and laughter. Not only did I feel more refreshed, but my clients benefited from having me see the whole of their lives. So with appreciative joy, we don't box people into a narrow segment of their life. It's a disservice to box people just into the suffering category. And then the same with life. We don't box life just into the suffering category. Even if I did give two full talks on it. We see that even in the most difficult circumstances, some joy or delight can be celebrated. The French philosopher Voltaire said, "Life is a shipwreck, but we must not forget to sing in the lifeboats." So mudita is our song in the lifeboats. I remember when my dad was dying, I was with him the last few days. And for those of you who've been with somebody who's dying, it's labor. It's hard, difficult work to die. And, even though that was going on, that his life ending, the labor of dying, I was also able to notice that he was comfortable, that he had good pain management, good pain access to pain medication, that he was surrounded by love, by people who cared about him. The Dharma teacher Christopher Titmus tells the story of a woman who was confined to an iron lung because of polio. And when she was asked how she could bear it, she said, "Every so often somebody opens the window and a breeze comes in." We can orient towards the beauty and pleasant events of the world. We've talked about this a lot, right? We keep talking about it because it's important. And if we are engaged in activism, can we have fun? The famous activist Emma Goldman said, "If I can't dance, it's not my revolution." How do we dance in our work? How do we play? How do we celebrate? A number of years ago, a fossil fuel company planned to route a gas pipeline through our small New England town. And then it was planned to go through northern Massachusetts, southern New Hampshire, and then end at an export terminal on the coast. Supposedly it was because Massachusetts needed more gas, but the export terminal was a little suspicious. And so it was fracked gas from Pennsylvania. And they had the survey all complete. I mean, they were pretty far along. And my husband and I joined an affinity group in our town. It's called the Sugar Shack Alliance. And the people in these different affinity groups, different towns, we were opposed to another fossil fuel pipeline. We believed that it would encourage fossil fuel use to build a pipeline, and that wasn't a good idea, that we needed to transition to sustainable energy. And so we strategized, how are we going to oppose the plans of this powerful fossil fuel company? One of our actions centered around building a replica of Henry David Thoreau's Walden Pond cabin, but we built it directly in the pathway of the proposed pipeline. So the pipeline was going through behind somebody's house, through a field behind somebody's house, and we knew exactly where it was going to go because they'd done all their surveying. So we built this little cabin right in the middle of where they were going to put the pipeline. And then our building inspector in town, he said, "Well, it's small. You don't need a permit to build it, but if you get a permit to build it, you have to get a permit to take it down." So we're like, "Well, we'll take the permit." and then he said, "You know, sometimes permits take a long time." And so we had a great time. We had picnics at this cabin and rallies and poetry readings and potlucks, and it was fun. And then other people started planning to build little cabins in the pipeline route. And eventually we succeeded. They withdrew that pipeline proposal. So then we thought, well, we'll just keep working in this area. You know, we were first inspired because it was in our town, but then we did some action in southwest corner of Massachusetts where they were going to construct a storage pipeline on state forest land. And it was a mess. It was against the, you know, they were overriding the Massachusetts state constitution. We moved our Thoreau cabin there. but we didn't win that one. They did build it. But we had a lot of fun trying. And we felt the power and satisfaction of doing something, of standing up for what we believed in. And then other members have moved on to trying to stop a coal train that goes every year to a coal plant in Vermont and other things like that. And now I know all these people in my town that I didn't know before. And I go to the farmer's market and I see people that I know. That's sustainable activism. And one of them, they have a farm. There's a young couple. Well, they're in their 40s, but that's young to me. And they have this great farm that they're making that it focuses on wild or native and climate resilient plants. And so one weekend they got 1,000 elderberry bushes. And, you know, we all went and helped them plant those elderberry bushes. It was great. Do something. Have to move on. So lastly, we cultivate the ability to let go of attachment to the results of our efforts. Equanimity. We relieve our hearts of the burden of demanding that things unfold the way we want them to, the way we think they should. We surrender. We surrender to life. We open the clenched fist of our heart. What we get in return is spaciousness, humor, not knowing, curiosity, freedom, clarity, and flexibility. All qualities that we need in today's world. So letting go of our demands sustains us for the long haul, prevents burnout, whatever, wherever we're engaged, whether it's activism or our work or caretaking. We do what we can and then it's out of our hands. The poet T.S. Eliot said, "Teach us to care and not to care. Teach us to care and not to care." So yes, we care, but the not to care is the letting go of the demand. And we never know. Life unfolds in such mysterious ways. We cultivate a big heart that's open to possibility. A big heart that doesn't need instant results. A big heart that is flexibly responsive and trusts in our capacity to adapt. Sometimes we just have to recognize that things take a lot longer than we may have expected. Here at IMS, we've been involved with anti-racism work for about 20 years now. And it's kind of slow. It's messy. It's slow. It's beautiful. At times, it's excruciating when I say things out of ignorance that I don't understand. Equanimity with this work means being okay that it's challenging, being okay that it's messy. Compassion sometimes means that we sign up to be uncomfortable as we're learning. And there has been change. We just graduated 15 teachers of color a little over a year and a half ago. Yeah, Devin was supposed to be with us. He was one of them, but he couldn't make it this time. It took 20 years to get there. Sometimes things take longer than we expect. John Lewis, the civil rights activist, said, "Do not get lost in a sea of despair. Be hopeful, be optimistic. Our struggle is not the struggle of a day, a week, a month, or a year. It is a struggle of a lifetime. You must be prepared to believe in something, and if you believe in something, you have to go for it. As individuals, we may not live to see the end." That's equanimity. Can you feel the spaciousness of that heart? And yet, equanimity doesn't cancel out passion. We follow our passion. We invest in what alleviates suffering. And yet, we open any place where we find rigidity, inflexibility, demand in our hearts. So we practice letting go over and over again of our agendas, our expectations, our wishes. And we experience equanimity as a relief from tension and contraction. Love deepens in our hearts as our hearts are freed from the cage of our own demands. I just read something today by a woman named Elizabeth West, and I liked it so much, so somehow I'm slipping it into this talk. I think it's relevant. Really, I'm coming at it through thinking about uncertainty. Uncertainty and equanimity live side by side. The ability to hold uncertainty. I know that some of you are going out into uncertain circumstances. It's a pretty uncertain world right now. On so many levels. How do we hold uncertainty? We need equanimity, that ability to rest in not knowing, rest in flexibility, adaptability. So Elizabeth West says, as I ponder how to live purposely on a planet that is passing through the portal, environmentally, politically, and economically, I find myself thinking of a good friend whose death I attended many years ago. I met Yoon Soo when she was 83 and dying from metastatic melanoma. The scope of her vibrant physical life had narrowed considerably, but her mind was at its peak and her spirit in its glory. She confided in me that she had just embarked upon the most thrilling adventure of her lifetime. She said, to be able to observe and to participate in the process of dying with full consciousness outshines any explorations I have ever undertaken. I watch with anticipation and excitement to see how this unfolds, how I respond, who I really am as I lose control of my life. Wow, that's enthusiasm, right? And uncertainty. I'm inspired by the open-heartedness and the. So these are other qualities we can count on, right? It's like curiosity and ability to letting go is through this whole story. Sometimes it takes a while to let go. A number of years ago, our next door neighbor clear cut his land next to us. And it took a year and a half. And I had to go on that journey. And it was heartbreaking. You know, every time I would hear a tree crash to the ground and just feeling the heartbreak of the land as their home was destroyed. And I kept asking myself, where is equanimity in this? What does equanimity mean in this situation? How does my heart find peace in the midst of violence? And this koan reverberated for a year and a half as the logging continued. It was quite a mess. You don't need all the details. And I vowed, one thing I did vow is I said, when it's over, I'm going to go sit with the land and I'm going to offer metta and compassion and healing energy to the remaining trees and the earth. So finally, after a year and a half, it was over. And so one beautiful spring day, I hiked up. And in the meantime, I was working it, folks. You know, it was hard. I was dealing. I was trying to hold the grief and the anger and all the different feelings that I was having. So I hiked up to the ridge, and I sat near the edge of the clear cut, and I was going to send these caring wishes. And it was so interesting because something didn't feel right. I sensed the trees communicating that they didn't want my compassion. They wanted me to sit with them in their pain. The trees that were on our land that were now all exposed, right? So I sat. I just sat and felt the trauma of the land, the trauma of what had happened, sharing the grief, sharing the exposure, the vulnerability. And after some time, equanimity, you could say, dawned on me as I accepted, fully accepted that this was the way things are. This was the way things were. That my resistance dropped away. And then the trees were ready for compassion at that point. I rested in caring and wishing healing for them. And then I started to see that new life was springing forth. So we sat together, the tree spirits, the earth, and I, sitting with things as they were in that moment. So perhaps under circumstances of violence and destruction, equanimity arises from the willingness to land in the truth of our hearts, to go on the journey of our hearts through whatever emotions arise, holding them with mindfulness, not feeding them, but feeling them in our body, giving them room until equanimity dawns on us. And we land in full presence, eyes open, feet on the ground, heart engaged. Heartfelt equanimity. So a few days ago, I was sitting on the rock. Remember the rock we started with? And I asked the rock, I said, "What can I say to the yogis about equanimity?" And the answer was, be grounded. Equanimity is grounded. And I thought, well, what else would a rock say? But it's still good. We'll take it, right? Be grounded. We can learn so much from all the beings of the woods, the trees. The trees have their own lessons about equanimity with the strong roots, right? And yet their ability to bend and move with the circumstances, they're like a perfect symbol of equanimity. But what's important for all of us is to be grounded, to learn how to have our feet on the ground and access our inner stability. That's another aspect of equanimity, is our inner stability. You can find a rock to help you if you want. They're good at it. All right. I've been reading a book from Kathleen Dean Moore called, I can't remember the name, but it's something about comfort, wild comfort. And she's great, Kathleen Dean Moore, somebody I just found. She says, make a vessel of your heart, a vessel big enough to hold your grief and sorrow, a vessel big enough to hold the wildness, a vessel big enough to receive grace and wonder and awe. Maybe that's how we love in the midst of suffering. And so whatever is our challenges in the world, whether it's activism or our paid work or volunteer work or caretaking. If we find ourselves struggling with how to care, we can take this template of the four Brahma Viharas and check, is there one of them that needs strengthening? Is there one that's not quite in balance? And then give extra emphasis to that one in order to help us feel strong and able to meet this world as it is. If our hearts, our activism is fueled by anger and ill will, how can we bring in more metta? When we find our heart is dried out and uncaring, how can we warm it up again? How can we bring in joy? When we're burning out in desperation that we're not making a difference, how can we develop more equanimity? Using the Buddha's brilliant framework for the heart, we joyfully give of ourselves because that's what hearts are called to do. I'm going to end with a very short little story quote here. This is from Douglas Pennant. Pennick in a Tricycle magazine of spring 2019. A longtime student of Sasaki Roshi suddenly left for an Indian teacher far less well known. What will happen to him? Asked a fellow student. Oh, Roshi replied, I don't think he'll find true love. I thought this was a remarkable formulation, but the person who told me the story said, oh, he says that sometimes when he means enlightenment. True love? Yes. Marinate in that one. Let's sit for a minute.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.